The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Rallying for Green Funds, How One Grant Has Positioned the Newly Established Justice Climate Fund to Competitively Apply for the EPA's $27 billion in clean energy funding. And the article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal. It's part of the 52 Shades of Success, Earth and Equity continuing series. The headline, Communities of Color Rally for Green Funds, a $5 million grant positions the Justice Climate Fund to apply for EPA's clean energy funding. And this is written by Connie Gentry. The heat is on for allocation of the $27 billion in the Environmental Protection Agency administered Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, or GGRF. A statute in the Inflation Reduction Act requires the EPA to distribute all of the GGRF grants by the end of September 2024. And that includes the $14 billion in the National Clean Investment Fund, or NCIF, and the $6 billion in the Clean Communities Investment Accelerator, CCIA. The notices of funding opportunities, or NOFOs and NOFOs, for both were announced in mid-July, as well as the $7 billion in the Solar for All competition that was unveiled at the end of June. And in an effort to ensure equity in the allocation of the grants, the Biden administration stated that two-thirds of the GGRF money, at least $18.6 billion, will be dedicated to low-income and disadvantaged communities. Taking a lead in that endeavor, the Community Builders of Color Coalition, which is spearheaded by the African American Alliance of CDFI CEOs, has established the Justice Climate Fund to support the development of competitive applications for NCIF and CCIA grants and to establish a transition team for the implementation and administration of any grants awarded. All the tools have to be in place because there needs to be a state of readiness to ensure we have the compliance pieces together and the administrative structure so once dollars go out the door to us, we can track everything, says Lenwood Long Sr., president and CEO of the Alliance and chair of the Justice Climate Fund. Applications are due mid-October and grants are expected to be awarded in early 2024, so Long emphasizes there is a very real sense of urgency and necessity in the receipt and deployment of those dollars. The Justice Climate Fund, which was awarded a $5 million grant from the Waverly Street Foundation last month, is in the process of hiring an interim CEO and four or five key positions to begin the process, with staffing expected to reach 20 to 22 people by the first of the year. What excited the Waverly Street Foundation was the fact that the 19 BIPOC-led organizations came together for a common purpose, says Long, referencing the coalition. It's been very important for us to realize that the work of the coalition reflects the diversity of America, and for the Justice Climate Fund to not only address reducing carbon emissions, but also ensuring environmental justice and equity in the administration and deployment of those dollars, he says. Several months ago, when Long learned about plans for the EPA funding, he thought of the role CDFIs had played in delivering Paycheck Protection Program, or PPP, loans to small businesses during the pandemic. 12 of the AAA CDFI members delivered more than $4.4 billion in PPP loans, and across the country, CDFIs were responsible for over $14 billion in PPP loans. His conclusion, CDFIs could again be the first responders to Main Street, and the BIPOC-led coalition had a history of serving low-income and disadvantaged communities. The National Association for Latino Community Asset Builders was the second organization to join the coalition, and Marla Belonik, president and CEO of NALCAB, is grateful that Long and the Alliance took the lead in making sure the opportunity created by the GGRF would have a big enough table for organizations led by people of color, she says. Through the coalition and Justice Climate Fund, she says, we are positioning ourselves to be a conduit for that unprecedented funding to funnel into our communities that are, not coincidentally, the most impacted by environmental degradation. NALCAB is a network of over 200 nonprofits that work to advance economic mobility for Latinos, but even with a national presence, most of the organizations in the coalition would not have the resources to individually pursue the GGRF grants. This opportunity is really emblematic of an issue where these big federal opportunities are not designed for organizations that don't have a professional proposal writer or experience pulling together large-scale applications, Belonik says. Our members are uniquely positioned to address the challenges on the ground, but we are less experienced with writing a winning federal proposal. There's a sense of urgency in securing the expertise to submit applications and administer grants, but there's also a sense of urgency to educate the public and the underserved communities that the Justice Climate Fund seeks to address. If you ask Main Street about the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, they'd be like, huh? One of my missions is sounding the alarm to black and brown entrepreneurs, telling them, don't let this moment pass you by, Long says. It's only going to happen from people understanding this moment, which I don't think they do. We have to sound the alarm to low-income and disadvantaged communities. Belonik has similar concerns, but says it's because environmental issues have felt more like long-term problems, and Latino communities, as well as organizations in the association, have been focused on immediate needs, jobs, housing, entrepreneurship, or financial access. Environment has felt like a luxurious afterthought, but now, because of this opportunity, it's gotten the attention of our member organizations, she says. And she also notes that 71% of Latinos say they feel their communities are suffering from climate change. Not surprising, given that more than half of Latinos in the U.S., 55%, live in California, Texas, and Florida, states that have experienced extreme climate events. It's interesting that the timing of this grants opportunity is this summer when it's impossible to ignore climate impacts. If I had to guess, I think the environment is no longer looked at as something floating on the side. It has become front and center, she says. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Rentals dropped so far this year. After vacationers swarmed the Outer Banks in the pandemic, occupancy numbers have trended downward this year as more normal patterns begin to return. For 2022, the area had more than $814 million in what the Outer Banks Visitors Bureau calls collections, which is gross sales for lodgings. That would include staples such as the Sanderling Resort, as well as Airbnbs and other rental properties. By comparison, the market had $518 million in collections from 2019, says Lee Nettles, executive director of the Bureau. Through May, those numbers this year were $177.7 million, meaning the market is pacing well below 2022, but is still ahead of 2019, $80.3 million when it comes to year-to-date comparison. Occupancy is down somewhat, but it's been kind of masked by higher rates, Nettles says, so the collections have been hanging in there. The pandemic limited vacation options, making the Outer Banks even more appealing. A key data presentation for local officials in April noted that the region was pacing at 70% occupancy for 2023 compared to 81% in 2022, but the average daily rate was $697, up from $617 a year ago. There are fewer rentals this summer, and I really see this as normalization as urban and overseas destinations have fully opened this year, says Tamron Kugler, the director of travel and tourism for Currituck County. This was expected. However, there has been less loss of revenue as the rental rates remain high and there is little discounting that I can see. In many ways, the Outer Banks are returning to a normal pattern. Nettle says collections generally grew about 4% until the pandemic, and of course that rise in interest came at a time when many businesses, especially seasonal ones, struggled with staffing. To be busy was a good thing, Nettle says. To be as busy as we were, coinciding with a national workforce shortage, was not sustainable. Swank Chapel Hill home draws big price. A residential property that once housed the original St. Thomas More Catholic Church sold with a $6.6 million price tag recently. The home, located at 740 Gimgul Road, adjacent to the UNC Chapel Hill campus, was built in 2009 on almost 4 acres of land. Christine Knapp, the Compass realtor who represented the buyer, says that although the house was built more recently, the owner preserved elements of the old church in the home. The dining room of this particular house, the original owner repurposed old church doors, she says. There are literally, in the doors, old holes from gunshots from back in the day. Knapp says the size and privacy of the land makes it unique. The size, there's just nothing like that in this area, nothing like this house, she says. Hotel, once again, has a new leader. A popular boutique hotel in downtown Durham is under new leadership again. The Unscripted Durham, known for its mid-century modern style and rooftop patio, has tapped Michelle Logel as its new general manager. She's the sixth person in the role since the hotel opened in 2017. I am thrilled to embark on this journey as the new general manager of our esteemed hotel, Logel says. With a passionate team and a commitment to exceptional guest experiences, we aim to make every stay a memorable and delightful one. Logel, originally from San Diego, had been the general manager for a Hyatt Place hotel in Orlando, Florida. The Durham Hotel marked the launch of the Unscripted brand by the Dream Hotel Group, which was acquired by Hyatt in February. The building, located at 202 North Corcoran Street, operated as the Jack Tar Motor Lodge in the 1960s. It now features 74 guest rooms and 6 food and beverage spots. More homes come available. Homes in a master planned community led by a Raleigh group have hit the market in Wilmington. East and Mason, a community of approximately 170 homes, offers 4 different home collections that range from roughly $500,000 to $1 million. Home prices vary based on size and amenities of each property. We are continuing to receive overwhelming interest from those who wish to make East and Mason their new home, whether they're looking for the convenience of a villa, a single-family home, or prefer to work with a custom builder to build their dream home on the historic Masonboro Sound side of the community, says Claire Reddick of Fonville Morrissey Barefoot. The firm, led by Raleigh native Audie Barefoot, has expanded its reach to a number of locations along the North Carolina coast. Buc-ee's could show revenue boom. Plenty of chatter continues to swirl around the potential for Buc-ee's to open along Interstate 85 between the Triangle and the Triad. The Texas company has shifted plans and now wants to put one of its massive convenience stores in Alamance County after plans for one in neighboring Orange County caused an uproar. But the new site in Mebane could end up being a boon for tax revenue in Alamance. After a Buc-ee's opened off Interstate 40 in Cumberland County, Tennessee last summer, that county saw a surge in sales tax revenue, more than $100,000 than what was anticipated the first month the store was open. And finally, industrial space comes online. The vacancy rate for industrial space in Raleigh and Durham rose to 4.4% for the second quarter, according to a report by Colliers. The increase could be due to 1.5 million square feet of new industrial space delivered during the second quarter. The largest delivery of the quarter was Buckhorn Industrial Park 1, Building 1, at 375,000 square feet, and is fully occupied by Thermo Fisher Scientific. There is still 5.3 million square feet under construction, most of which is speculative projects in order to remain attractive to a variety of tenants. Average asking rates for the second quarter were $9.60 per square foot. And now we turn to the top news stories in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one is written by Ben Tobin. Nash County leaders look to put casino debate to a vote. Leaders in an eastern North Carolina county marked as the potential site for a casino have a message for state lawmakers. Let our constituents decide if they want one here. On July 31, the Nash County Board of Commissioners voted 6-1 in favor of a resolution calling for a referendum to give voters the power to decide if a casino development could move forward. Currently, commercial casinos are banned in North Carolina. There are 3 tribal casinos operating in the state. The vote comes after recent reports of Republican leadership in the North Carolina General Assembly working on a bill that would allow casinos in Nash, Anson, and Rockingham counties. Nash County is appealing in part because Interstate 95 runs through the county between Nashville and Rocky Mount. According to reports, one company would invest at least $500,000 at each casino and create at least 1,750 jobs at each one. State House Speaker Tim Moore told reporters in July the intended locations of the three casinos. Nash County Board of Commissioners Chair Robbie Davis told Triangle Business Journal that the board as an entity has not been approached, quote, and knows very little about it, unquote. Davis says he went to a meeting a few months ago where he saw plans of what the casino entailed, but he declined to disclose what they entailed and whom the meeting was with due to a non-disclosure agreement he says he signed. In explaining his rationale for the referendum, Davis says his constituents deserve to have a voice. It will be a controversial decision, he says, and I found in my 21 years of being a commissioner that the fairest way of dealing with controversial items to your voters is giving them a chance to be involved with it. Nash County cannot hold a referendum on its own, according to Davis. The state legislature would need to approve the request. When asked about his personal stance on a casino coming to Nash County, Davis says he opposed it, mainly for fear of the addiction gambling can cause. It will take away from people's income that could be used to supply other things that are needed in a home, he says. J.P. Morgan to ramp up in the state. Bank already has grown a North Carolina presence, but will double that. This article is written by Lauren Onasorge. J.P. Morgan Chase & Company is doubling down on its plans for North Carolina, and that includes its Raleigh branch network. Initially, the plan was to open 40 new Chase Bank branches in North Carolina. By the time J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon cut the ribbon on North Carolina's first branch in 2019 in Chapel Hill, he said it was the start of what would be 50 branches. Now, J.P. Morgan says it is doubling the stakes. Already, the New York finance giant has 48 branches in the state, including 15 in the Raleigh area. The plan now is to increase that to 100 statewide by the end of 2025. The plan includes 5 new branches in the Raleigh region through 2024, says Ryan Jackson, market director for the firm's Charlotte market. This would definitely be that double-down moment, he tells Triangle Business Journal. Jackson, who moved to Charlotte a year and a half ago for the job, says Diamond's experiment, opening a slurry of de novo branches across the country, is working, and North Carolina checks the boxes. I don't think there is a top 10 list that you don't see Raleigh, Charlotte, or North Carolina showing up on, he says. The next domino to fall is the triad. Jackson says the bank's first Greensboro branch opens at the end of the month, to be followed by 2 more in 2024. That we've already started hiring for, he says. Jackson didn't comment on whether the Silicon Valley Bank situation has driven additional clientele to the bank locally. When SVB fell, some entrepreneurs said they plan to move their money to J.P. Morgan, attracted by its too-big-to-fail reputation. But nationally, that appears to have been the case in the days after the crisis. On an April earnings call after SVB collapsed, J.P. Morgan CFO Jeremy Barnum told investors the bank saw significant new account opening activity and meaningful deposit and money market fund inflows. Its deposits grew by $50 billion following the March banking crisis. In North Carolina, Jackson says the bank is trying to be a really great partner when it comes to being there for our clients, but also being there for our community as a whole, he says. Jackson says he welcomes any interest in J.P. Morgan. In the meantime, he's working to grow his own operation. The bank is adding 24,000 square feet of office space in Charlotte, hiring more than 200 additional people in the city, primarily in back office, technology, and support roles. And our next article is written by Zach Ezone. Pharma, with local ties, inks deal worth up to $650 million. A pharmaceutical company with operations in Mooresville has secured a deal worth up to nearly $650 million to license its multiple sclerosis treatment outside of North America. TG Therapeutics on August 1 disclosed a deal that grants Neuraxpharm Group an exclusive license to commercialize TG's treatment, Briumvi, in Europe and other countries outside of the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. As part of the deal, TG will receive an upfront cash payment of $140 million with the potential to receive more. TG will receive an additional $12.5 million upon the launch of BriumV in the first European country. TG is also entitled to receive milestone payments, milestone-based payments worth up to $492.5 million plus royalties. TG retains an option to buy back all rights under the commercialization agreement in the event that the company is acquired within the next 2 years. Retaining this type of strategic flexibility was core to our considering an ex-U.S. transaction, CEO Michael Weiss said during a recent earnings call. The deal follows BriumV in June receiving regulatory approval in Europe. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the reporter pages, starting with Lauren Onosorge's page on tech and finance. Maddie Energy looks to make comeback in NC. Brand born at Duke is now owned by a New Hampshire company. Quietly, a homegrown energy drink is returning to shelves in North Carolina. Maddie Energy, spelled M-A-T-I, the startup beverage brand founded in entrepreneur Tatiana Bergeson's Duke University dorm room, scored fans like AOL co-founder Steve Case before shuttering completely in 2020. NOBL Beverages, a New Hampshire-based maker of cold brew coffee, soon swooped in to buy the brand for an undisclosed sum, but it's taken a while to find its new footing. Connor Rolke, founder and CEO of NOBL, says part of the reason is a lack of corporate presence in North Carolina. The plan is to rebuild its local network, and Rolke says the firm plans to hire someone locally to double down on its North Carolina shelf presence in the coming weeks. NOBL Beverages didn't set out to buy Maddie, just its manufacturing equipment, from pasteurizers to giant steam tanks. While in town to see the equipment, company officials learned the brand was coming up for auction, so it finalized buys of both the equipment and the brand in 2020. Relocating Maddie was a production. Rolke estimates shipping 11 truckloads of equipment from North Carolina back up to New Hampshire. We literally disassembled their entire plant and shipped everything out, he says. It took us 3 or 4 weeks to get everything moved. Demand from the customers the brand had left behind seemed strong, but selling the cans in North Carolina has been a challenge. NOBL is a New Hampshire company with zero presence in the Tar Heel State. And its legacy brands were taking off, meaning a balancing act between sustaining and growing demand for what it already had in New Hampshire and meeting the needs of a new-to-NOBL market, North Carolina. But today, it's starting to take off, with Maddie available locally in places like Happy and Hale. Rolke hopes to someday get the product back into Whole Foods in North Carolina, and the new hire, expected this winter, could help reinvigorate the brand in its native state. We would really love to be back in that region, Rolke says. SVB's fall inspires $10 million fund. When Silicon Valley Bank fell, Nomico founder Mark Noel was paying attention, soon rallying stakeholders to create a pool of capital so his companies wouldn't be dependent on a financial institution the next time it needed growth capital. Noel, the Triangle entrepreneur behind innovations such as the pool noodle and synthetic wine corks, recently closed on $10 million. The fund, called Noberg LLC, and disclosed through a Securities and Exchange Commission filing, was raised primarily from existing shareholders, he says. With everything that happened in the banking system, I wanted all our companies to be totally independent from banks and not have any bank debt, says Noel, describing Noberg as purely a financial holding company that helps finance the growth of his companies. And finally, Ponzi scheme was stunningly unprofitable. Despite boasting of 100% win records and 210% returns through multiple Facebook posts, Dream Venture Capital Group, the options trading firm founded by a project manager at UNC Chapel Hill, was stunningly unprofitable. That's according to what Edward Sullivan, an attorney for the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, told Judge Catherine Eagles in a federal courtroom in Greensboro on July 27. Sullivan, like Dream Venture Capital Group's sole operator, and fellow defendant Naeem Chowdhury, appeared virtually, their images projected on a computer screen while Eagles oversaw the proceedings. Oh, and actually one more article. Carry app developer shuts down. Oak City Labs, a Carry app developer, closed as of July 31, CEO Carol Versalino posted. She said on LinkedIn, "We built a great team, one that I'm incredibly proud of and will miss seeing every day." And now we turn to Zach Ezone's page on healthcare and higher ed. Behavioral health suffers a big loss. UNC Health lays off employees as contract ends. A 10-year agreement between Wake County and UNC Health is nearing an end after the two sides failed to reach a deal to extend the partnership. The health system has operated the county-owned Wakebrook Behavioral Health Facility on Sunnybrook Road in Raleigh for nearly a decade, but that's ending as the two entities couldn't reach an agreement to extend an existing contract that ends September 30. As a result, UNC Health informed the North Carolina Department of Commerce on July 21 of its plans to lay off 246 employees. UNC Health says it will try to help these employees find other positions elsewhere within the health system. Wakebrook plays a big role in the behavioral health services that Wake County supports. The county during fiscal year 2022 had a behavioral health budget of about $35.3 million, of which about $14 million supported services at Wakebrook, according to a report released in May assessing the county's behavioral health services. The county says it's searching for a new service provider to succeed UNC Health at Wakebrook. Wake County and Alliance Health, a managed care organization that serves multiple counties in North Carolina, are in negotiations with a new provider to deliver services at the facility. It's unfortunate that after discussing several different proposals with UNC Health, we could not settle on terms for a service contract, Wake County manager David Ellis says. Wakebrook is an important care center in our community, and we're committed to minimizing the gap between providers so we can continue to serve our residents battling mental health and substance use issues. UNC Health is working to find new positions for its Wakebrook employees, spokesperson Alan Wolf says. It is using a priority placement program to provide affected employees with priority access to interviews and job openings, including looking for opportunities to transition employees to UNC Health Rex in Raleigh or the Medical Center in Chapel Hill. UNC Health operates a large network of hospitals and clinics across the Triangle, and we will collaborate with each employee to identify new positions that fit their experience and interest, Wolf says. Judge puts ICVIA acquisition on hold. ICVIA's proposed acquisition of an advertising firm has been placed on hold as federal regulators try to block the deal. ICVIA and Propel Media reached an agreement with the U.S. Federal Trade Commission to delay their merger at least until November 23, as a federal district court judge reviews FTC's request to block the deal. The acquisition is on hold until the November deadline, or until 3 days after the court rules on the FTC's request for a preliminary injunction. The FTC is seeking a preliminary injunction that would prevent ICVIA from completing its acquisition of Propel Media until the federal agency has had a chance to adjudicate the legality of the deal through an internal administrative trial. That process began with the FTC on July 17 filing an administrative complaint to block ICVIA's acquisition of Propel Media. And finally, Chapel Hill Biotech targets fentanyl crisis. A small biotech in Chapel Hill is trying to tackle one of the largest health challenges in the U.S., the fentanyl crisis. Cessation Therapeutics has received authorization from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to advance its lead program, a monoclonal antibody, into a phase one trial. The biotech aims to deliver the first FDA-approved product for the prevention of fentanyl-related overdose, and this initial clinical study is a step in that direction. In 2021, synthetic opioids other than methadone, primarily fentanyl, contributed to nearly 71,000 overdose deaths, according to data from the National Institute on Drug Abuse. And now we turn to Laura Bramet's page on retail and restaurants. Jay Betsky's finds its groove after move. German eatery moved from its Seaboard station spot in 2021. Jay Betsky's, one of the Triangle's only Central European-inspired restaurants, served Polish and German fare in the Seaboard Station neighborhood for 15 years. The restaurant left the location in August 2021, hoping to escape construction woes, John Korzowinski says. He owns Jay Betsky's alongside his wife, Catherine. The building where Jay Betsky's used to operate was demolished to make way for the Seaboard Station project by developer Hoffman & Associates. Hoffman was redeveloping and we moved, Korzekwinski says. We didn't want to go through a whole construction period. The first phase of the Seaboard project is already complete, featuring a seven-story building with 30,000 square feet of retail space, below-ground parking, and 298 apartments. The second phase is under construction, promising another seven-story apartment building, a hotel with a rooftop bar, and more retail to deliver by summer 2024. A third phase will then follow. We work closely with Jay Betsky's to best accommodate their needs and provide them a space in Seaboard Station. Ultimately, they decided to explore a new venture, and we wish them lots of success in their new location, says John Florian, Executive Vice President of Development at Hoffman & Associates. Jay Betsky's reopened in November 2022 at 1916 Bernard Street in High Park Village. It was a whirlwind. Everything was a mess because of COVID, Korzekwinski says. It was a hard process because I thought we'd be open much sooner and nobody could have anticipated all the delays. Korzekwinski had to ask the restaurant's investors for more money and burn through personal cash as well due to cost overruns, he says. Jay Betsky's paid a stipend to some of its core employees that stuck with the restaurant during the closures. Others found substitute work. It was a miracle to get here. I sit here every day and look out the window like, I can't believe we made it, Korzekwinski says. I told everybody if we get open, we're not going back, and so far, we haven't. Cookout owners reimagining Raleigh spot. A former KFC is being turned into a new concept from the owners of Cookout. Located at 1221 New Bern Avenue next to a cookout, the property is owned by an entity registered to Cookout CEO Jeremy Reeves. The building is in the process of being renovated and now boasts signs reading Roo's Chicken. The Cookout team opened a concept named Taco Roo's in Wilmington in 2020, but that location is now closed. Permit filings with the city of Raleigh show the Roo's Chicken location was originally set to be named Taco Roo's, and Roo's is R-O-O, apostrophe S. Taco Roo's was located at 429 South College Road and opened in April 2020. It is now a regular Cookout location. The new restaurant will have a drive-thru and serve breakfast. The building measures about 2,100 square feet, according to Wake County property records. Cookout purchased the lot for $900,000 in April 2021. And our last story, UNC buys site of former nightclub. A nonprofit affiliated with UNC Chapel Hill has purchased retail space on Franklin Street that was formerly home to the library, a bar and club popular with students. Haslam Roberts Family LLC and JPD Franklin Street Property LLC sold the property at 120 East Franklin Street for $1.7 million. UNC is one of the largest landowners in downtown Chapel Hill and has acquired numerous properties along Franklin Street over the years. The new property is near but not part of the university's Porthole Alley redevelopment project. And now we turn to On Real Estate, written by Kaylee Thompson. Wake Forest adding boutique townhomes. Developers plan to build 12 units not far from downtown. Boutique townhomes are under construction in Wake Forest on the edge of downtown. Real estate firms Chapel and Concept 8 have partnered on another missing middle development, the pair's first one in Wake Forest. The townhomes, called The Forest on Franklin, feature 12 farmhouse-inspired units near Kiwanis Park. The Forest on Franklin will have 3 and 4 bedrooms and range from 2,500 to 2,900 square feet. The homes will have open spaces with screened-in porches, designated flex spaces, storage, and 2-car garages, along with an optional private elevator. The townhomes will be 3 stories. Prices will start in the high $500,000s and reach the mid $600,000s of dollars. Construction has started, and the companies expect to complete construction by spring 2024. The Forest on Franklin is at 601 South Franklin Street, a lot totaling just 0.04 acres. The property is owned by an LLC addressed to Concept 8 and has an assessed value of $57,000. The LLC paid $215,000 for it in April 2022. We need more housing more than ever, and we're thrilled to be a part of the solution in this inventory-stricken market, says Johnny Chapel, owner and broker of Chapel. At the same time, The Forest on Franklin will deliver an elevated approach to local lifestyle with high-end features and luxury amenities, including private elevators. And while we work all across the region, from inside the Beltline Raleigh to Chapel Hill, you can't beat the historic charm of this area, and our homes will fit nicely into the fabric of the town, he says. National builders grab land in small towns. National home builders continue to buy land in the Triangle, showing there is still strong interest in the area. In the last 2 months, three different national builders have bought land to build residential developments, with a focus on the fast-growing towns within a short reach of Raleigh. In Wendell, Pulte Group of Atlanta recently acquired 41 lots totaling 4.72 acres in the McKenzie Meadows subdivision in Wendell. Pulte paid about $3.24 million in early July, according to deed records. In Zebulon, Arizona's Meritage Homes Corporation bought 168 acres for $13.8 million in late June, according to Wake County records. That land is located at 705 Pony Road, just off U.S. Highway 64. Cadence Meadows will have 158 townhomes and 248 single-family homes. Also in Zebulon, D.R. Horton of Texas closed on 118 acres for 4.8 million records in June, according to deed records. And finally, affordable housing to rise in Raleigh. An affordable housing development on the edge of downtown Raleigh that's years in the making is moving forward with construction. A development group intends to break ground this month on Toulon Place, that's spelled T-O-U-L-O-N. Toulon Place, a 200-unit apartment complex off Garner Road near John Chavis Memorial Park. All of the units will be designated as affordable housing. The complex will include 78 one-bedroom units, 92 two-bedroom units, and 30 three-bedroom units offered for between 40 and 60% of the area's median income. One-bedrooms will range from $802 to $1,203 a month. Two-bedrooms from $963 to $1,444, and three bedrooms from $1,113 to $1,669. And our last reporter page is on Greater Triangle Growth, written by Ben Tobin. VinFast defends its financial footing. VinFast breaks ground in Chatham County for $4 billion plant. Never mind the poor early reviews, a delayed production start date, and a lack of brand recognition in the United States, on July 28, Vietnamese electric vehicle manufacturer VinFast took a victory lap at a groundbreaking ceremony for its new $4 billion plant at the Triangle Innovation Point Park in the Chatham County town of Moncure. A celebratory atmosphere permeated throughout the ceremony as confetti showered VinFast leaders and North Carolina politicians while they shoveled dirt. During the program, Governor Roy Cooper said the state has wanted an automaker for decades. The uplifting mood comes against the backdrop of what has been a challenging year for VinFast while the company tries to navigate how to finance the $4 billion project. On the same day of the groundbreaking, VinFast announced the company may soon be trading on the U.S. public markets after completion of a Special Purpose Acquisition Company, or SPAC, deal. The company says its planned combination with SPAC Black Spade acquisition has been approved by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. The deal, which values VinFast at $27 billion and makes it a public company, is expected to close in August. It's one step forward after several steps back. Early reviews from U.S. drivers of the VinFast VF8 claim the vehicle instilled motion sickness, with one critic noting the vehicle has the worst body control of any modern car I've ever driven. On top of that, after announcing last year that vehicles would be ready to go in 2024 from the North Carolina plant, VinFast pushed the production start date back by a year. And the rain turned into a downpour for the manufacturer after it recalled all 999 VF8 City Editions in May after U.S. regulators raised concerns. But VinFast Global CEO Lee Thi Thu Thai isn't flinching at the setbacks. "We have a clear vision about what we do," Thai told reporters at the groundbreaking. "We have all the ingredients, but it takes a lot of hard work. There will be a lot of challenges along the way, but people need to recognize we've come a long way." Raleigh firm picks fast-growing Clayton for new townhomes. The largest town and one of the fastest growing counties in North Carolina is getting a new subdivision. Raleigh developer Marsh & Partners is planning to build 41 townhomes on 4.4 acres near downtown Clayton off Highway 42 between Woodbriar Road and Barber Mill Road, according to Matt Marsh, a founder and principal at the company. The Clayton Town Council approved a request earlier this month to rezone the property from office institutional and residential estate uses to single-family residential. Marsh says the company plans to break ground on the project called Woodbriar Townhomes early next year and finish the first home by the end of 2024. The biggest desire for the project is to create a walkable, urban-type townhome project in close proximity to downtown Clayton, Marsh says. And finally, new flex space at Chatham Park to open. The first flex industrial space within the massive Chatham Park development will soon welcome new tenants. The Chatham Park Commerce Center, located off the Eubanks Road near the U.S. Highway 64 business split in Pittsburgh, will complete its first building in the fall, and tenants can move into a 60,000-square-foot industrial space by the end of the year, according to Kyle Greer, president of McKinnon Property Group, the developer of the project. According to Lee and Associates, the group in charge of leasing the property, the walls went up at the new building earlier this month. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to A Better World, inside the Triangle's nonprofit scene. GSK grant boosts Kidzu program. GlaxoSmithKline has awarded Kidzu Children's Museum in Chapel Hill a Ribbon of Hope grant to support the museum's STEAM, Science, Technology, Engineering, Art, and Math, and Literacy initiatives this summer. As part of this initiative, Kidzu hosts Family First Fridays, where the museum is open for free the day. The July Family First Friday drew nearly 600 children and caregivers that were able to visit and interact with engaging and educational STEAM programming for free. The next Family First Fridays at Kidzu takes place August 4. Family First Fridays will continue past this summer and throughout the 2023 to 2024 school year. In addition to Family First Fridays, the museum is offering free STEAM activities through its weekly Junior Gardeners program, monthly garden parties in Kidzu's outdoor learning garden, and outreach activities at the Chapel Hill Farmers Market. Winona Judd to keynote Foundation for Hope Gala. The Foundation for Hope, which supports mental illness, has named country music star Winona Judd as the guest speaker for its annual gala held September 13 at the Angus Barn Pavilion in Raleigh. The foundation dates to 1984 and was founded by Thad and Alice Ure, whose son, Thad, had bipolar disorder but who found limited resources for help. Judd's mother, Naomi, died of suicide on April 30, 2022. The event will feature a meal and an auction. Last year's event featured keynote speaker Marie Osmond and raised more than $850,000. Food Lion donates funds to support hunger relief. On August 1, Food Lion held a preview event at its new store located at 2460 Stantonsburg Road in Greenville and celebrated its support of East Carolina University and its Farm to Clinic initiative. Through Food Lion Feeds, the grocer's hunger relief initiative, it made a $150,000 donation to support access to healthy food and improve nutrition and health for uninsured, low-income diabetes patients in rural eastern North Carolina. The partnership supports a mobile teaching kitchen and food distribution unit specifically designed to improve access to healthy food and support improved nutrition and health for uninsured, low-income diabetic patients in rural eastern North Carolina. Food Lion Feeds is also providing $74,000 to the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina, Greenville, and New Bern branches. The investment will support the purchase of equipment for agency-related capacity building, enabling its community partners to respond to the increased demand for families experiencing hunger. And finally, Firm's Collaboration Day includes Raleigh site. Over 100 team members in seven markets from Century Business Consulting LLC, an accounting and advisory firm, recently worked together to give back to their local communities at the company's first company-wide Community Collaboration Day. The Community Collaboration Day saw the Century team donate 637 hours of time and more than $20,000 to local nonprofits across the company's footprint in Raleigh, Boston, Denver, New York City, Philadelphia, Tampa, and Tysons, Virginia. At Century, our core values aren't just words, they are the driving force behind all that we do, says Michael Aiello, CEO and managing partner of Century. Our company-wide Community Collaboration Day is a testament to our commitment to these values and our focus on actively engaging with the communities where we live and work. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor-in-chief of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, CRE sector has a trump card, new residents. If you keep up to speed with the various pieces of economic news thrown at us on a regular basis, the current plight of the commercial real estate sector stands out front and center, primarily because of COVID and the work-from-home strategies implemented by companies worldwide. Physical office buildings in downtowns have struggled enormously in the past 3 years. If foot traffic drops during the day, retail establishments suffer. But for office and retail developers, the check writing process of covering their loans does not stop. And if tenants start leaving these buildings or simply go out of business, the math becomes almost impossible. Now, top that off with what is going on with the credit markets because of inflationary pressures. The Federal Reserve has raised interest rates from 0.25% on March 16, 2022, to the current 5.50%. There is no amount of math available to make the numbers work for developers and lenders, unless, of course, borrowers want to shell out large chunks of money to cover the equity. History shows that does not happen. Borrowers would rather walk away from distressed loans than pour good money after bad. Keeping that CRE framework in mind, on August 1, we gathered a few CEOs of large real estate companies such as Highwoods Properties, Grub Ventures, and Beacon Partners to discuss the challenges and perhaps forecast the end of this brutal environment. And what we heard was that the current headwinds likely will be a short-term challenge, although many may not agree with the short-term timeline. The panelists said things are unlikely to get better until 2025. That prediction is based on the current monetary policy staying at current rates and without any further rate hikes, and capital markets not icing further because of the deteriorating economic conditions. These are two huge ifs, and they could easily not come true. Then, what are we looking at? 2026, 2027, and we haven't even talked about the $1.2 billion CMBS loans in the Triangle staring at maturity dates. How do you refinance them at these rates? But there is one trump card out there that allows some breathing room for places such as the Raleigh-Durham metro area. Our economic activity is among the best in the nation. Mayor Marianne Baldwin confirmed at the event that Wake County continues to see about 62 new people a day moving into cities like Raleigh, Cary, Apex, Holly Springs, Wake Forest, and others, and local economic development folks believe the surge of inquiries from companies looking to relocate and expand has jumped measurably. While that trend creates challenges for housing prices and affordability, it's a lifeline for an office and retail building owner looking to lease these vast amounts of empty spaces. So folks who have the ability to hunker down and weather these headwinds will eventually gain from the growing tailwinds. We have some big short-term problems. Interest rates, inflation, costs have not come back, said Beacon's Pete Lash. It's almost impossible to get deals to pencil today. It's not so much the cost of capital, it's the availability of capital. It's harder to get a loan today than it was a month ago. Highwoods' Ted Klink opined, since COVID, two-thirds of all job growth in the entire country is coming to the Southeast. Any headwinds we have are going to be offset by growth. For now, numbers show that is to be the case. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we'll read some of the big number sections that are sprinkled throughout. The first big number is $36 million. That's the size of the financing that Kinsale Bio launched with after spinning out of Inceptor Bio, a cell therapy firm based in Morrisville. Kinsale, a contract development and manufacturing organization, is forming around a manufacturing facility that Inceptor established about 2 years ago in Florida. And the next number is 57. That's Raleigh's ranking on the University of Toronto's Downtown Recovery Rankings Analysis, showing the city at 44% recovered, but the Downtown Raleigh Alliance put the area's recovery at a higher percentage, and DRA President Bill King calls the Toronto analysis incomplete at best due to the map used. 930. That's how many apartments are being planned for Southwest Durham next to New Hope Commons and Patterson Place Shopping Centers. Avalon Bay Communities is developing the multifamily project. It's first in the Triangle. And our last big number is $8.25 million. That's the listing price of a coastal home in Belhaven in Beaufort County with 14 rooms situated on 59 acres. And now we'll read the quotable sections. These used to be he said or she said sections. The first one is a quote from Southwest Airlines CEO Bob Jordan speaking on the firm's recent earnings call. The Dallas carrier operates out of Raleigh-Durham International Airport's Terminal 1. While our network is largely restored at this point, it is not optimized, especially for post-pandemic shifts in business travel. And our next quote is from Shankar Ramaswamy, CEO of Cryotherapeutics, on the company raising an additional $150 million to advance its gene therapy programs. We have an ambitious goal to advance gene therapies to highly prevalent diseases that affect millions of people around the world. Next, we have President and CEO Mike Munn on McAdams' expansion to the Triad. The new Winston-Salem office is the sixth for the Raleigh engineering firm. Expanding across the state allows us to stay in front of development trends and investment is associated and investment in associated infrastructure while improving our accessibility to clients. Next, we have Vivek Denkanikote, TREP research analyst, and that's TREP, T-R-E-P-P. The challenges maturing CMBS loans will face this year with higher interest rates include increased borrowing costs, potentially lower valuations, and a tighter lending environment, making it more difficult for borrowers to refinance their loans. And our last quotable is James Anthony, Vice President of Acquisitions for APG Capital, after his company bought a roughly 40-acre former paper mill property in Wilson. Wilson, we think, is very centrally located. Everybody's always talking about the I-85 corridor, but I don't think they're talking about the I-95 corridor enough because the cost of land and the cost to buy existing real estate there is less than comparable real estate on I-85. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn back to the Viewpoint page to read the guest column. And this is written by John Hood, who is a John Locke Foundation board member in Raleigh. The headline, State Economy Rests on Diverse Portfolio. The late Harry Markowitz, who won the 1990 Nobel Prize in Economics for his work on portfolio theory, reportedly said, diversification is the only free lunch in investing. By distributing your savings across a broad base of stocks, bonds, and other asset classes, you maximize long-term gains and minimize risk, assuming that the performance of the assets in question isn't strongly correlated. Does the same wisdom apply at large scales? What about cities, regions, and states? When economies rest on a few industries or a handful of large employers, residents tend to experience a bumpier ride. When those key industries or companies prosper, so do the communities in which they're embedded. When sectors or firms falter because of managerial errors or larger events such as adverse weather and technological disruption, dependent communities can sink into deep economic recessions even as the rest of the country powers on. To say a ride is bumpier, however, is not necessarily to say it's not worth taking. Perhaps the good times are so good that the bad times are a reasonable price to pay for it. In the economic development literature, you can find evidence for both models. Still, I find myself persuaded by advocates of diversification. In 2013, for example, the Journal of Economic Development published a study examining the economic diversity and performance of U.S. counties from 1990 to 2007. It concluded that economic diversity has a positive impact on economic growth. An earlier paper in the journal Land Economics also found that diversity was associated with both higher growth rates and lower levels of economic instability. Putting it another way, the World Bank observed in 2019 that a lack of economic diversification is often associated with increased vulnerability to external shocks that can undermine prospects for long-term economic growth. If so, North Carolinians have good reason to celebrate. According to a recent study, our state has one of the most diversified economies. Decades ago, a University of Utah economist named Frank Hackman devised a way of measuring the economic diversification of communities and states. The latest version of the Hackman Index, published in March, ranked North Carolina sixth in the country. Only Missouri, Georgia, Arizona, Illinois, and Utah have more diversified economies. Which economies are the least diversified? No surprises here. North and South Dakota, Alaska, Wyoming, and West Virginia constitute the bottom five states, dependent as they are centered on drilling and mining. Now, to say it's better for an economy to be diversified is not to say policymakers ought to go to great lengths to try to engineer such an outcome. It would be silly for governors and legislative leaders in Alaska or the Dakotas to throw up obstacles to oil and gas drilling on the grounds that their residents ought to find work elsewhere. Also, the politicians in question wouldn't be governors or legislative leaders for long. What isn't silly, though, is for policymakers to remove barriers to entrepreneurship and to welcome new industries. That's just good sense, and it's been good for North Carolina. And in our final minutes, we'll read as much as we can of the executive voice that focuses on MZ Wooers. The headline, looking ahead at a legendary club, Wooers leads Durham's Hope Valley Country Club, whose history dates to 1926. This interview was by Cameron Snipes. Armed with more than two decades of experience in the golf industry, MZ Wooers has settled into her role as the leader of one of the Triangle's most exclusive private golf clubs. July marked 2 years since she was named general manager of Hope Valley Country Club in Durham. The club was founded in 1926 and was a collaboration between golf course designer Donald Ross, clubhouse designer Amer Embery, and landscape designer Robert Cridland. In addition to 18 holes of golf, the club boasts a resort-style pool complex, 8 tennis courts, 3 pickleball courts, and a 50,000-square-foot clubhouse. With an initiation fee of $20,000, Hope Valley ranks number 8 on Triangle Business Journal's list of private country clubs. The club has 676 members and employs just under 100 in season, Wooers says. In 2020, Bobby Jones Lynx, an Atlanta area company, was selected to manage the club. What led you to your current role? I just celebrated 2 years at Hope Valley. I took a job during my freshman year of college as an accounting assistant for a controller of a local golf course and never looked back. I've worked many positions in the industry, golf shop attendant, beverage cart, F&B manager, events manager, catering sales. I spent 13 years as a membership director before stepping into the role of general manager. I've been fortunate to be surrounded by wonderful coworkers who helped foster opportunities and supported me in taking on new roles. And actually, we're going to have to stop there and not get to the rest of the questions because we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.